I would like to go into the Heart Sutra, as it is called, of the Prajnaparamita, which is one of the supreme texts of Buddhism, and particularly of Mahayana Buddhism. This sutra is called the Heart Sutra, Hridaya Sutra. We must bear in mind that the meaning of the word heart should be understood first. I would like to translate it for our purposes as the essence of mind. Mind in its own essential nature. It has nothing to do with the physical heart, of course. And it hasn't anything to do with that type of psychical functioning which we ascribe to the heart in the emotional sense or in the sense of that which is the core of the intellectual aspect of what one may be considering. Mind in its own essential nature is practically synonymous with awareness, not discriminative consciousness, but awareness. Discriminative consciousness comes into play and is always at play with us as long as there is the knowing subject as a separate entity observing the object about which he wants to gather knowledge. That is discriminative consciousness. But this word awareness, which I use, I am using in the sense of the state of awakened transcendent mind in which there is no separation between the observing subject and the observed object. Now this word Hridaya gives me that sort of feel. See, we in almost any language we have phrases to suggest this meaning, the heart of the matter, by which we mean the very essence of the matter, the very core of the matter. But when we get to the realm of essence, to the very core of the matter, am I separate from the matter? Or is the separation between the matter and what I commonly call myself completely bridged? So that in reality, there is only the one whole present. And if I am aware in that sense, then I am not aware, I am not conscious in the separative sense. Your logical intellect will immediately flare up and say, this is just a lot of words, what are you talking about? Well, I don't offer any defense because there is no need for defense. If a person has realized through living experience, and another person has not realized similarly through living experience, it is no good trying to argue about the form in which you attempt to communicate the transcendent. It's no good. One just has to remain silent. But if a person is willing to investigate and he is willing to let the critical, discriminative consciousness be at rest and allow himself to take the first steps through his feeling mind, then one can converse, talk together. This talking is in reality then a talking by both people simultaneously, the one loudly, audibly, the other silently, and simultaneously is listening by both people. Because in these matters, we enter the realm of communication, which I have sometimes spoken of as spiritual induction, just as we have magnetic or electromagnetic induction in ordinary physics. Similarly, between two living beings, there is this extraordinary thing which I call spiritual induction. It has to use certain forms in order to introduce the two to each other in right relationship. But as one proceeds, as one enters into it, one goes right beyond the forms. And in that going completely beyond the forms, one has left discriminative consciousness behind, and one is aware. One has become it. If you can get the feel of this right now, what I'm trying to suggest, you will see, just like that, the truth of that statement which I have made so often during the last year particularly, that in the transcendent sphere, which is right here, it's not out there or anything, it's right here in the transcendent sphere, awareness and being are identical. Two words, but the same reality. Two words just to help us where communication is concerned. That is all. Now, Hridaya, then, has brought out all this. Now this Prajnaparamita means Prajna is insight. Insight in the sense of seeing transcendentally, which again means no separation between the observing subject and the observed object. It is essential for us to understand all this as the background to looking at the sutra itself. Otherwise, we always miss the main road. We get turned off to some alley or down some alleyway. Prajna is unerring insight. That seeing which is faultless seeing. And that faultless seeing, remember, is the same as being. Paramita. Paramita, one meaning is excellence. Another meaning is obtained by splitting the word into its two parts. Paramita, beyond this, which is the ordinary. The wisdom or insight which is beyond the ordinary. The wisdom that has gone beyond, or if you like, transcendental wisdom. Bearing in mind what we have considered together these few minutes, this transcendental wisdom, therefore, is not some kind of, not some wonderful piece of knowledge. Knowledge consists of intellectual formulations, verbal formulations ultimately. Knowledge is acquired. Knowledge always remains the separate something which we put into our mental pockets and shopping bags and all the rest of it. That is knowledge. All acquired knowledge can be put under the one heading, science. Science is that which is made known in the ordinary way. The ordinary way being the use of our senses and the analyzing and synthesizing process which this computer brain indulges in. Absolutely essential. It's indispensable. We can't escape it at any time, in fact. But nevertheless, that is knowledge. And it is the put together after our sense activity by a brain which is conditioned and which is subjected to its abilities on the one hand, its confusions and disabilities on the other. It's what we commonly describe as virtues on the one hand and greed and resentment and delusion and so forth on the other. And on the purely intellectual level, the strongest, the most powerful obstructions are our biases, our prejudices, our preconceptions, and our assumptions. But where there is transcendental wisdom, none of those exist. And when we come to the stage where we want some intellectual expression and a verbal formulation of what is there through transcendental wisdom, then we have to recognize this extraordinary fact, that to each and every single logical proposition, as well as to its converse, we have to say yes as well as no. Otherwise, we are in the realm of untruth in the transcendental sense. This is a brain smasher. But there we are. In a way, you will appreciate that the time is ripe for this sort of brain smashing. Not brainwashing, that's mere wishwash. In the world of things, we have our cyclotrons and bevatrons and whatnot, and marvelous machines by which we can smash up the atom. We can send back matter to its eternal home of primordial energy. Maybe that its twin brother in the mental sphere also has to make his appearance now. So bear this in mind. Each and every single logical statement, and to its converse, one says yea as well as nay, and takes no sides whatsoever. What is its significance? What is the significance of this, therefore? I must recognize that I, as the I, can never know the truth. There is no such thing as knowing the truth. I can be the whole truth, provided I have, let me use the common phrase, developed spiritually sufficiently far to enable the I, the separate, limited I, to disappear altogether in terms of consciousness. When discriminative consciousness has at last found its Sabbath, which is its eternal home in God's own being, then that transcendent awareness, which is what the theist calls God consciousness, is working. God, the perpetually awake, is also the perpetually resting, the perpetually slumbering. Man realizes that in his own sphere. But it's a realization. So, I as an I, with discriminative consciousness, can never know the truth. If I really see that, I will never attempt to grasp or cling to this, that, or the other idea, teaching, extraordinary experience, or anything whatsoever. And in that total freedom from grasping in any way or on any or at any level on any plane is man's fulfillment. Man, let me use the Judeo-Christian terminology. Man who exists today as the fallen, sinful Adam is once more completely at one, completely reabsorbed, completely restored to his pristine condition of man who is God's own living image and therefore God's own living being. The split in Yahweh's being which occurred when Adam sinned is healed. The wound is healed. Now, keep this. Not so much keep it in mind. I was going to say keep it in mind. But be awake to this as we now look into this Heart Sutra. It starts off in the usual way with an obeisance. Homage to the perfection of wisdom, the lovely, the holy. Avalokita, the holy Lord and Bodhisattva, was moving in the deep course of the wisdom which has gone beyond. He looked down from on high. He beheld but five heaps, and he saw that in their own being they were empty. Avalokita is the one who looks down. The name means that. And he is actually Avalokiteshvara, and the Ishvara part. Ishvara means God, the personal God. In Hindu terminology, Ishvara is the nearest counterpart to the popular Christian personal God as an individual being idea. Ishvara. Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva, was moving in the deep course of the wisdom which has gone beyond. Moving. What sort of a movement is this, and where does it take place? He has translated it as deep course. Gambhiram. Gambhiram means deep. But it means deep in the sense of serious. Serious, the word serious, in the finest sense of that word. This is a serious matter. In Gujarati we say gambhir bina che. Gambhir. This is quite a serious thing. Not with the implication of fear or anxiety attached to it. Deep, profound. In the deep course of the wisdom which has gone beyond. Perhaps I better use the actual text also. This is how that sentence reads. Arya Avalokiteshvaro Bodhisattva Arya is the holy, the worthy. Avalokiteshvaro Bodhisattva Gambhiram Prajnya Paramita Charyam Charamano Vyavalok Yatai Sma. See, was moving in the deep course of the wisdom which has gone beyond. But what sort of movement is this when you are in that state of awareness? It is no movement in space. There is no spatial sense. There is no time sense about it. There is no sense of activity in the way in which we understand the word activity. A mental activity of any sort whatsoever. There is no activity in that sense. Because all these are disturbances to that transcendental action which is just being. This is the mystery which can never be spoken about, can never be expounded or explained. Being, action, love, truth, beauty, goodness, wisdom, all these words, they are all one and the same thing. Why? That we can answer. Because in terms of transcendence, all differentiation has vanished. This is something we must realize. In terms of transcendence, all differentiation has vanished. If you look at all the teachings in the great religions, of the emergence of the primordial, undifferentiated deity into manifestation, you will find that in that primordial state there is no differentiation whatsoever. And the question is asked, well, how did the first movement start? We don't know. That's a simple fact, and we never can know. Otherwise, we'd be doing the same thing ourselves, wouldn't we? We always do just what we know. We can't do what we don't know. You might ask, how on earth was it possible for any man to put out such teachings? Because after all, these teachings in the great religions were put out by you and I, people like you and I, no one else. There was no Lord God who came down and studied Greek or Hebrew or Sanskrit and went to China to get his parchment and quill pens and goodness knows what not and write out the scriptures, nothing of the sort. A human being, you or I, and not so very long ago, a bare 23 to 25 centuries ago only, wrote. How did he manage to write? Because it was his realization. That is all. He entered into a state. And after he came out of that state, his mind and his speech faculty formulated that state in this manner. And the extraordinary thing is that the formulations, whether they were made in China, Lao Tzu for example, or whether they were made in India or Iran or in the Semitic lands, they are almost identical, with certain very interesting and enriching variations. That is all. But a man did it, don't forget that. Therefore, it is an experiencing which any one of us, if we have that urge, if it is our natural inner nature to be like that, we can experience and find out for ourselves. So, this movement is no movement. But everything vibrates, doesn't it? Everything vibrates. And if it vibrates, as for instance the way atoms and molecules vibrate, we looking at them say that, oh, they are perfectly still. That is a silence. So, whoever wrote this himself had entered that state. And then he tried to convey it in these terms. He looked down from on high. That means in that state of transcendental awareness. You can't look down or up or sideways or anywhere in the state of transcendental awareness. And you might question, well, is this true then? Is this an accurate statement? Of course not. And of course it is. Don't forget, all the opposites apply simultaneously. This is important. What are you looking at? If one has entered that state where the separative, discriminative consciousness has become completely restful, how do you look at anything? To look down means, of course, you're looking at something. But you can't. This is the only possible way, or maybe there are two or three other possible ways similar to this, by which you can attempt to convey the impression, an impression of what that transcendence is like. We have no other tool but words. You can draw pictures of matters transcendent, but then you know what happens. You can get lovely art, but if we are concerned with the inner reality which this art is representing, then that inner reality is certainly not grasped, not understood. And you can't become that inner reality through the medium of the expression, the art. Can't do it. It's the same with the words. He beheld but five heaps. And these five heaps in the Buddhist sense, of course, refer to the Buddhist analysis of the empirical man. The empirical man. Mervyn Pateman or Firoz Mehta or Sidney Penry or whoever it is. Or the empirical woman. Laurie Alder or Jana Vana Yakish or whoever it is. You see? That is the empirical man. And the empirical man in Buddhist analysis, as you know already, is presented in a fivefold form: the appearance, the feelings, sensations, really. Vedana literally means sensations. So it includes physical sensations, which means the functioning of the nervous organism and the nervous system of the body and so forth. It also includes our feelings in the sense of an emotion. It also includes all that aspect of our intellectual functioning which are just mental feelings. If you observe carefully the way people talk, I think so and so. He doesn't think anything of the sort. He has no grounds for thinking it whatsoever. No grounds whatsoever. He just has a feeling about it. That is all. all just in the air. And 99.99% of all those feelings are sheer nonsense, rubbish. So many illusions and delusions, if you look carefully into them all. You see, this is quite like nature, isn't it? Nature is prodigal and very wasteful. Nature will throw away 220 millions in order that just the one out of those 220 millions may come to fruition, flourish. This is nature's way. And this is exactly what we do in terms of our so-called thinking. Prodigal, wasteful, we squander. We are natural squanderers, natural wasters. But if you really understand it, then we can be at peace about it, because there is love, there is compassion. Understanding and compassion are inevitably together. You can't separate it. So he beheld but five heaps. Now, I didn't finish. Vedana, sensation; sanya, the ideas. The ideas are the clear thoughts, clear conceptions, based upon proper observation and reasonably true. For example, what we call a statement of the laws of nature, anything like that, you see. Those are sanya. Those are at least relatively true perceptions. Those are sanya, ideas. Or if you plan out something, you think out something which is actually practicable and can be put into operation, those are sanya. That's the third element. Rupa, Vedna, Sanya, then the Sankhara, as they are called, the mental formations, that is to say, groups of a whole lot of thoughts in a system as such, or a whole lot of thoughts and feelings put together, or when we describe somebody's character, that's a sankhara, a confection, a put together. You see? What we call complexes are also sankhara. What are illnesses of the mind, which are, or what are excellences and capacities of the mind, they are all sankhara. All the philosophies, the systems of thought, the doctrines, the explanations, they are all sankhara. They all come under the term sankhara. You see? That which is put together. That is the essential meaning. And the fifth element, vijnana, the discriminative consciousness. And it is discriminative by virtue of the fact that we have our five physical senses, and in Indian thinking, the mind as such is also called a sense. It's the sixth sense, the mind itself. Thought, imagination, all that constitutes a sixth sense, not something of a different order of reality from the functioning of our eyes, ears, nose, and so forth. Now, these, which in the ordinary way for us are very real, substantial things, facts, you see, from the point of view of transcendental wisdom, are but empty heaps. They have no substantial reality. Now remember, it's going to be yes and no to the statement. And it is going to be yes and no to the opposite statement. that they are not insubstantial heaps. They are not empty. They are also the fullness. This is the trouble when we enter into things like the Heart Sutra and into the realms of the transcendent. Makes it very difficult. The Prajnaparamita itself says the contradictory things. You see, in other sutras, and you'll find precisely this sort of thing through several of the Yoga Upanishads. So many statements are made, 100 statements we'll say, and the whole lot of those statements are afterwards negated, and both are presented as the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. You may wonder why. Is this sheer madness? Is this complete craziness or what? Well, approach it this way. Do we, in the ordinary way, ever challenge ourselves? If I see a car in the street, I say, well, of course, that's a car. I am quite convinced that what my eyes convey to me is true, of course. And I have this attitude with respect to all my functioning throughout the day, in all respects. I am always right, of course. Isn't that so? This is where we are such funny creatures, we mortals. It never occurs to us that we may be unwhole creatures. Creatures who are just a bundle of things somehow thrown together in a miserable old heap inside this box of the skin. Skin is the box which holds all this together, including mind and brain and whatnot, everything. It never occurs to us. This is Dr. Quinn's private office. We are always convinced we are right, whatever we do, whatever we think, whatever we see. Sometimes we get into an anxious state. Oh, I wonder if this is the best thing to do. But secretly, you know, you do think it's the best thing to do. Because despite all the best advice in the world against it, you will do just what you wanted to do. So it never occurs to us that we are anything but right. It never occurs to us that we cannot. We always have the feeling, of course, I can.
Never mind, Lethbridge Stewart. Too late now.
But I have to see. I have real, not just superficially with the top cortical layer up here, but really to see, yes, this is so, that I cannot. I am incapable and ignorant. Then only transcendental wisdom will function through me, the living organism, and I won't know how. These are but 5 heaps, and in their own being, svabhava, their own nature, they are empty. You know, we have gone into this consideration of emptiness quite a lot last autumn. You remember? We spent at least 3 or 4 meetings trying to understand what is meant by shunyata, the emptiness. Let me just put it very briefly like this. The transcendent is realized when all this that we ordinarily are conscious of is negated, is denied. The negation and the denial mean essentially this, that we are aware that as seen by my discriminative consciousness, that's not the whole truth. That's only a fragment of it all. And it is the passing expression, the ephemeral, the mortal, the limited, the finite. But that finite has its the being of that finite has its roots in the absolute being of the infinite. It is not the counterpart of the infinite, of the infinite. Do remember that. This is the difficult part of it. This is where, when we try to give illustrations of the teaching of Shunyata, we always fall into the pit. You remember last autumn, we considered the word cavus, Latin, a cave. But would there be a cave, the emptiness within, if there were not the solid rock or whatever it was which formed the outside? The human being is presented as empty in a similar way. The personality, the empirical man, this fellow, whoever he is, you see, the outside, the personality is this outside, ephemeral manifestation of the transcendent inner emptiness, the no-thingness. The personality is the thing. And the no-thing lies at the heart of it. In that sense. But when we present it in that sense, unfortunately, because of the use of words, we separate the two, don't we? This is just the ephemeral mortal stuff, and this which I can't see, hear, taste, touch, think, etc., is the immortal, the infinite, etc., etc., and I separate the two. And this is where the mistake lies. Just as in all the theistic theologies of the world, we separate God and the devil. It's the devil that keeps God going. He's the chap that does all the doings, the drama and the hey-ho and the jolly-o. And because we have to pay the price for it always, that we receive the stimulus which makes us find in what is the devil rooted. And he is rooted in the eternal being of God. And if I can't see the devil that way, then I can never understand him or love him or transform him. So now, this emptiness does not mean, therefore, that this and that in ultimate terms are separate. See, this Heart Sutra is a very hard nut to crack. Very hard nut indeed. Here, O Sariputra, Avalokita is speaking. Form is emptiness, and the very emptiness is form. Now you see, here is a verbal formulation which makes the thing difficult. On the one hand, there is this form, the person, the living person. We say form is emptiness, and then we say emptiness is form. But in our minds, our vijnana, the discriminative consciousness, is functioning. And especially when we use words which apparently denote quite opposite things, we get mixed up. And we say, oh, but this is emptiness and that is form. That's where the error lies. The one total reality is emptiness form, hyphenated. Spirit matter, God devil, mind body, infinity, finitude. Look, it's very easy just to pour out words, and one gets caught in the sort of swirl of words. But you see, if all the time, whilst we are listening or speaking or reading or thinking or meditating or whatever it is, if we do not grasp or seek to grasp at an essential, substantial truth or reality, so that we can have the satisfaction of saying, ah, at last I've got reality in my pocket now, then the reality is there all the time. We never saw it before. Awareness being, the two are identical. And being is total being, not separate being. The word I, we have gone into this several times in these past years. The word I has only one real meaning, and that is the totality. See, this is where the Jewish tradition is really quite marvelous. We talked about it a bit on Wednesday, you remember, at the lecture. The mystical no thing, the Ain, A-I-N, goes through all the different transformations. This is how the Jews present it. The emanations from Yahweh, which end up with Yesod, which is power, and Malkuth, which is the kingdom. And the kingdom is also the Shekinah, the glory. That's why in the Christian prayers we still have the power and the kingdom and the glory. And often we miss out the kingdom and the glory, Malkuth and Shekinah. One reason being that it is this kingdom and glory which were lost, were sent into exile by the sin of Adam. Therefore only the power is spoken of. Yes, sir, you see. But when Yahweh has emerged in that manner, on his own divine plane, in his own divine transcendent way, he who began as Ain, no thing, ends up as Ani. Instead of A-I-N, it is now A-N-I, and the word Ani means I, the self.
Can you read me, Roger?
Oh, yes, of course.
Roger, are you reading me up here, Rod?
Of course, all the great.
We're trying to get in for about 3 minutes, Roger. Thank you.
See, this is how the Jews put it. The Jews couldn't possibly put it in this sort of form, because the forms in which these things are given out are completely dependent upon your heritage, your socio-cultural heritage. And by cultural, I'm including the realm of religion. There. Now, emptiness does not differ from form, nor does form differ from emptiness. All the separations come because of this. My brain functioning dualistically, I cannot escape. I cannot escape the limitations of dualism. So I have to say things like this. But if you feel it out in the terms in which I have just presented it, that form is rooted in emptiness. It's of the very stuff of emptiness, to use a paradoxical phrase. And emptiness is the very essence of form. Then perhaps this discriminative consciousness separation will not worry. The same is true of feelings, perceptions, impulses, and consciousness. Here, O Shariputra, all dharmas are marked with emptiness. Dharmas, the plural of dharma, dharma simply means an event of sensory and mental experience. Any sensory and mental experience means dharma. The word dharma, especially in Hindu presentation, also stands for religion. In Buddhist presentation, in Pali, dhamma also means religion. The doctrine, the teaching, the truth, the norm for living which leads to ultimate realization, which is enlightenment. Dhamma means all this. But the plural used in this way, both in the Pali and in Sanskrit Buddhism, is specific to Buddhism. Dharmas means events of sensory and mental experience. And one other meaning too, dharma means the essential nature of anything, but with special reference to the mind, rather than things like chairs or tables or anything like that. The essential nature, dharma, it's dharma, its own nature. See, despite what Buddhism said, that everything which we experience is anatta, is annitya, which means relative, therefore impermanent, changing, ephemeral, perishing. You see, despite what it said, it along those lines, it time and again was compelled to bring in this svabhava, own nature. You see the difficulty of language? It's extremely difficult to talk about things like this. All dharmas are marked with emptiness. They are neither produced nor stopped. The word for stop is nirodha, which is translated rather too strongly by the word extinction. Extinction not in the sense of annihilation, extinction in the sense of completely passed away. Faded away, completely faded away, in that sense. You see a cloud in the sky. And after a time, the cloud has completely vanished. The cloud has reached its nirodha, its utter fading away. That is what the word nirodha means. And it is often translated as stopped. Neither defiled nor immaculate, neither deficient nor complete. All dharmas, all events of sensory and mental experience are the opposites together. What is the point of all this sort of thing? He who sees, who reaches clarity, real clarity, when he sees all this, he remains poised. He remains at peace. And it is not a poise and a peace which is just a kind of a personal reward for him. Not at all. It means that through him, this universal life force, this universal energy, which manifests, now works unhindered for good. Each time you have a flash of illumination, each time you experience any sort of enlightenment, you have benefited me, you have benefited everybody in the world. A benefit not to be measured, not to be seen, not to be grasped at. Woe to the one who will grasp at the benefit, because then the benefit will be like an anchor and his ship cannot sail on. It's stuck. See, that is why the Bodhisattva takes the vow of renouncing his nirvana. There's a profound significance to it. But it's very hard to see that significance. Very hard. But the logical intellect plays all kinds of tricks. The Bodhisattva is one who has not realized nirvana yet. Well, how can you renounce what you haven't got? See the difficulty with words, 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 all along the line. All right. Therefore, O Sariputra, where there is emptiness, there is neither form, nor feeling, nor perception, nor impulse, nor consciousness. No eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind. No form, sound, smell, taste, touchable, object of mind. And so on. And ultimately, no mind consciousness element. There is no ignorance, no extinction of ignorance, and so forth. Until we come to, there is no decay and death, no extinction of decay and death, no suffering, nor origination, nor ending, nor path. There is no cognition, no attainment, and no non-attainment. All the opposites are stated. Now, just one word. Therefore, O Sariputra, where there is emptiness, there is neither or. There is not all this. Instead of the word emptiness, which is a difficult word, therefore, O Sariputra, where there is transcendence, there is neither this nor that. But everything is rooted in the transcendent. Now, do not think, therefore, that the conceived transcendent, the object of adoration, God or the enlightened one or whatever it may be, is the source, the material source of the objective universe. Not at all. Look, I know neither the transcendent nor the material world. I don't know them. My discriminative consciousness functions in a way which gives impressions about the objective world, gives me certain impressions. Pragmatically, in the world of affairs, if I am reasonably sensible and have sort of trained myself and have learned certain know-hows and skills and so forth, I can get along, move about, without being immediately exterminated by the next bus or whatever it is. That is all I can do. For 2 million years, at least, I have sought to know matter. And after these 2 million years, with all my science and everything, I'm still asking the same question: what is matter? And the answer is, I'm still finding out. And the fact is that I shall never end the finding out process, because the word I represents this which has its insuperable limitations. Now, in the same way, I can enter into deep states of consciousness by denuding my mind of all the images and so forth, and I reach a state which for this creature is an ultimate, an end point if you like. But that is not the end. In terms of the transcendence, there is no beginning, there is no ending. There is the essential absolute isness. Not finite, therefore not measurable, therefore not cognizable in ordinary terms, or even in what we commonly call extraordinary or profound terms. You see why it is called the wisdom gone beyond. See, this is where theologians and devotees of the theistic religions remain blind to an insuperable difficulty. They postulate God is the ultimate. Having defined their God, or whatever it is, then all the rest is built up by man out of it, a wonderful cloud palace, city of the Gandharvas, as it is put in the Lankavatara Sutra. See? And of course, having this blind faith, that's to say, in reality, this blind belief, they just go round and round, happy squirrels in a nice gilded cage, and there we are, doing many good works, of course, quite seriously, yes, but that's all. But when you see the impossibility of realization of ultimate reality, then you can, or rather, the wisdom that is gone beyond can function through you, the living being, without your knowing it. And it will always function without your knowing it. Because the moment there is any element of I know about it, there is the door is closed. At once. You see, this in a sense is the counterpart to the doctrine of grace. The grace is neither deserved nor undeserved. You can't put your finger on it. You can't analyze it. You can't hold it. You can't do anything about it. It is that. That is all. The beauty of the world is there. Wonderful beauty. from the time I am born till the moment I shall die, how much of that beauty am I awake to? Sometimes I thrill in response. The series of sensations are over. But have I entered the heart of that beauty? And it is the same with love, with wisdom, with goodness, with truth. Do I ever enter into it? Can I deliberately enter into it? No. Can I deliberately get rid of this separative self-consciousness? No. Just let the quietness steal into you. And the state of transcendence is least obstructed then by the person. And when that happens in an extraordinary way, a wonderful way, then things like this Heart Sutra emerge. Therefore, Sariputra, point to a bodhisattva's indifference to any kind of personal attainment. And through his having relied on the perfection of wisdom, the Prajnaparamita, he dwells without thought coverings. Therefore, O Sariputra, going to a bodhisattva's indifference to any kind of personal attainment. Indifference, upekkha, is associated with the word upekkha. Upekkha, in its deep sense, means equanimity, poise. It needs indifference as one of its bases, because if one is not indifferent to anything and everything, then one exercises discriminative choice and grasps at this or puts aside that. When you neither grasp nor push aside, that transcendent indifference really is this transcendent poise. This is action. Where no disturbing activity goes out of me. Then that is transcendent action. This is the real meaning of the indifference. That state of awareness, which is so calm, so understanding, so loving, so true, that this being has reached the stage, is in the condition of complete harmlessness, complete poise, a dynamic poise. Now, owing to a bodhisattva's indifference to any kind of personal attainment, and through his having relied on the perfection of wisdom, he dwells without thought covering. The Prajnaparamita operates through that person. What we commonly call his mind no longer exists at all. He is mindless. And the meaning of that is that this extraordinary receptive, responsive sensitivity that belongs, that characterizes every living being, every living organism, functions utterly unobstructively. All the particular ideas, thoughts, beliefs, convictions, conclusions, etc., the whole lot of them, and they are actually physically associated with the brain cells and chemical activities and whatnot and whatnot, and they keep making paths inside the brain and all the rest of it. I mean, physiologists know about this sort of thing, you see. all that is out. And when that is out, there is nothing to obstruct this light of eternal truth. The man of the world will say, well, what do you get out of it? Don't answer the man of the world.
The inside man.
Can we open the door?
It's too hurtful to him.
What happens when they come out shooting?
They won't be. Canister will have cyanide gas. They'll be quiet.
He dwells without thought coverings. And because he dwells without thought coverings, his intelligence is fully awake, fully capable, and he sees the truth of things, of persons, of events, of situations immediately. You know, it's one of the extraordinary things. You can experience it to this day. You can come across people. The moment they see you, they know you. They just know you, all of you. This receptive, responsive sensitivity is now no longer hindered. It is not a case of mind communicating with mind, as if there were two separate minds. But this, the receiving set, simply gives out all that it receives. That is all. There is no hindrance. This is the state of unity. Where is the separation? To the physical eyes, of course, there is this body and there is that body, this object and that object. But in terms, as far as you and I as human beings are concerned, in terms of awareness, where is the separation? And if there is no separation, there is no finitude. And if there is no finitude, there is no birth, there is no aging, there is no death. This is immortality realized here and now, made real. And in this state, where of dynamic poise, the birth-death process goes on simultaneously all the time, in perfect rhythm. And what we commonly experience in our life as psychological time is completely in step with chronological time. Therefore, this awareness is the expression, is the actual manifestation of immortality here now. There is no immortality for a physical body, of course, for any living organism. This is the realization of immortality. When there is realization of such immortality, there is no grasping for self. Selfness is out, completely out. In the absence of thought coverings, he has not been made to tremble. He has overcome what can upset in the end, sustained by nirvana. For our purposes, look at nirvana in its negative form. That is the only way we can see it. Nirvana is the total absence of greed, of hate, of delusion, and all that stems out of greed, hate, and delusion. The total absence of that is nirvana.
The purpose of all this is not to depose King Hussein or defeat his army. Lately, the Arab states have been getting their share of military humiliation from Israel. They don't need it from each other. Rather, every once in a while, the guerrillas want to make sure everyone knows.
How did Adam and Eve tear apart the tree of life and the tree of knowledge? Both trees are one and the same tree in the divine being of Yahweh, in terms of all his emanations: wisdom, intelligence, mercy, compassion, justice, majesty, endurance, power, kingdom and glory, the whole lot. There is your tree of life. There is your divine man. You find this put in a different way in the Trismegistic teachings. Very wonderful, really, how they all tally, if one has the intelligence to see the way they tally. How did that tree of life and that tree of knowledge, we'll still use the word knowledge, are one and the same tree in the divine being? Now, please do not think of a divine being as outside one. This is all within oneself. It is a man who produced all this. You see, and it was man in the state of realization is Yahweh. That is Yahweh. Now, how did Adam, the earthly Adam, tear apart the tree? Grasped after knowledge. Grasped after knowledge. Lured by the statement that he would become as Yahweh himself, as the Elohim. It was Elohim, Yahweh Elohim, that is to say Yahweh in his aspect as Elohim, who gave the advice. Command is a bad word, bad translation, which we have in the English Bible. Gave the advice, or warning if you like: you can eat of all these trees, the fruit of all these trees, but if you take this one, this is what will happen to you. And actually it didn't happen. They didn't die. They were only chucked out of Eden. Bad enough that was. See? Eve, which the mother of life, the name of Eve means the mother of all that is living. And the mother of all that is living is the other part of the whole name Yehovah. Hava is the feminine part, Yod is the male part, Yah. And Yah is associated with the divine wisdom, in which knowing subject and known object are still a completely unseparated unity. In Bina, intelligence, and incidentally wisdom, is Abba, the father. Isaac Luria and his school, who followed Moses de Leon, made that identification. Mind you, Moses de, well, I better mention all three names: Abraham Abu Lafia, then came Moses de Leon, then came Isaac Luria. They overlapped each other. They flourished at the same time as Eckhart, Dante, St. Thomas Aquinas. What an extraordinary century. You see, Abraham Abu Lafia introduced practically what is Hindu yoga into Jewish mysticism as a technique for realization. Moses de Leon, who produced the Zohar, gave this very marvelous presentation of the evolution of the divine being himself in his own sphere, in his own divine sphere, of which the world is a copy. But in the world of things, the objective world, Adam, the earthly Adam, slipped up. The divine Adam, which exists in the Sephira from here to here, in the but the earthly Adam did. Now, Elohim represents the two aspects, the great Who, which is Yahweh himself, Me, that is M-I, and Ele, the other part of the name, is the what. So Elohim represents God in his perpetual separating out the knowing subject, Me, and the known object, Ele. But because it is on the divine plane, the separating and the rejoining take place immediately. And this is what guarantees the continued existence in time and space of the manifested universe. These are extraordinary things to look into. We will see similar processes as faint reflections of this ideal presentation in our own ordinary daily lives. This is the value of such things. I mean, of course, if you're not interested in such things, you'll just leave them alone. But if you are interested, you'll see some very wonderful things. So that's Elohim. So Elohim gave the advice. But the earthly Adam and Eve couldn't carry it out. They separated the male and the female aspects. They didn't. You see, Eve got tempted. The desire element, the feminine element, is the desire element. Now you'll understand why Plato, in his philosophy, apparently so arbitrarily and unjustly called the female principle the evil principle, and the male principle, the rational principle, as he called it, as the good principle. You see, poor old Plato has been slated heartily because of his anti-femininity. but one has to understand these. Plato knew all about these things. He really was an initiate in the grand sense of the term. He did know, and he presented it that way. So it's this graspingness, this desire nature. And desire grasps always at the relative, and not, in fact, desire cannot grasp the absolute. The absolute can be understood, can be realized by enlightenment. It can never be grasped. The relative is the realm of the conflicting duals. But this relative, the realm of the conflicting duals, is rooted in the absolute. It has its being in the absolute. This is the mystery. This is why when the redemption takes place, the all-in-allness of the, if you like to use the theistic word, God, or of Brahman or Atma or the absolute, takes place, and there is complete cessation. But you see, all this belongs to the realm of transcendental wisdom, the wisdom that has gone beyond. In the end, sustained by Nirvana, he has overcome what can upset. In the end, sustained by Nirvana, sustained by the complete elimination of greed, hate, and delusion. All those who appear as Buddhas in the three periods of time, they all, fully awake to the utmost right and perfect enlightenment, because they have relied on the perfection of wisdom. Therefore, one should know the Prajna Paramita as the great spell, the spell of great knowledge. He uses the word knowledge, but vidya is not knowledge in our English dictionary sense of the word knowledge, the thing known as outside us. It is become vision. Become knowledge, if you like. So that it is not a thing for discriminative consciousness, for analysis and synthesis, which both lie within the realm of the duals. As the great spell, the spell of great knowledge, the utmost spell, the unequal spell, and he's using the word spell here as the magic power. You know, the word, the name Brahman, one of its great meanings centuries before the birth of the Buddha was magic power. See, magic power in this sense, as you have in the Old Testament. And God said, let there be light, and there was light. That's magic, isn't it? In that sense. The allayer of all suffering. Now remember, this word suffering, don't tie it down to pain and misery and all that sort of thing. That's just kindergarten stage. Suffering, dukkha. The far from the infinite, the absolute spoilt by becoming the relative. This is dukkha. The spoilt absolute. The relative is the spoilt absolute. And the relative is the spoilt absolute only insofar as I, a man, am unawakened. Because it is this mind in its limitation here which is trying to see and sees things in terms of conflict and therefore of misery and all the rest of it. Confined to the realm of the duals. You see? Suffering. By the Prajna Paramita has this spell been delivered. See, it is time, isn't it? Yes. It runs like this. Gone, gone, gone beyond. Gone beyond. Gone altogether beyond. Oh, what an awakening. All hail. When the bud really knows the root, knows itself as the entire tree, it blossoms, it flowers. This blossoming and flowering is like the realization of transcendence. I, as a human being, am the shadow form. When the being of God stands in the way of his own eternal light, the light envelops me all the time. It's all around me. But I remain as a shadow, the separated something, as long as I am unenlightened. And I remain unenlightened as long as I grasp at my shadowhood. But when I have let go my shadowhood, let go all selfness, this shadow has become light, and God is released from casting a shadow.